Welcome to the HN Pod. We're your daily guide to what's happening on the Hacker News front page.
Yep, digging into the big stories.
It's April 20th, 2025, and if you're listening, you probably want the quick scoop, right? Get the insights without drowning in comments?
We do the drowning for you.
Huh, exactly. We scan the top posts, pull out the key discussions. Think of it as your shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
So today, we're hitting five big topics that got the HN community buzzing. First up, Google's Gemma 3 AI models, making them run on regular computers.
Oh yeah, the QAT models. Big deal.
Then there's this whole debate about fixing movie mistakes, specifically in Revenge of the Sith.
Always a fun one. Art versus tidiness.
Kinda. Then we'll get into Zig's comp time feature, what it does, what it doesn't do.
A bit more technical there, yeah.
Definitely. After that, a wild story about a calculus integral that apparently took like 100 years to solve.
The second integral. It's a great history lesson, actually.
And finally, OpenAI buying a company from Windsurf. For a lot of money.
For $3 billion, reportedly. Raises eyebrows.
It certainly does. Okay, let's dive in. First, those Gemma 3 QAT models.
Right. So powerful AI, you usually think massive data centers, right? H100s, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Google's Gemma 3, their latest open source one, seemed like that at first. Needed the big guns.
These large language models, they soak up computational power, training them, running them. Usually not something for your home PC.
But Google's introduced this thing called quantization-aware training, QAT. Mm-hmm. And somehow this lets optimized versions run on consumer GPUs, like an RTX 3090. We're talking the 27 billion parameter model.
Yeah, the 27B. That's a pretty sophisticated model. Running locally, that's a shift.
How does that QAT actually work, roughly?
Well, quantization in general is about reducing the precision.
Oh.
Think fewer decimal places for the numbers inside the model.
Mm.
Makes it smaller, less demanding.
Okay.
Quantization-aware training means they train the model knowing it's going to be quantized. So they try to minimize the accuracy loss during that training process.
Ah, so it's not just chopping bits off afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's designed for it. It's like compressing an image smartly versus just crudely lowering the resolution. You try to keep the important details.
Gotcha. And people on Hacker News are definitely trying this out. Someone said the 27B QAT is their new favorite, like Mistral small level.
Wow, good.
Running on an M2 Mac using maybe 15 to 22 gigs of RAM.
That's impressive. On an M2 Mac, it really shows how far optimization and hardware have come, doesn't it?
Yeah. And think about the possibilities. Privacy is a big one people mention.
Oh, absolutely. If you can process sensitive stuff, journalistic notes, personal photos without sending it to the cloud, that's huge.
For sure. Another user was talking about performance, getting like 20, 25 transactions per second or tokens per second, probably on an A5000.
Decent speed for local inference on a model that size.
And some folks brought up, you know, the philosophical side. Using local models means you're not directly paying cloud providers who might have trained on data you didn't consent to.
That's a recurring theme in the AI space, isn't it?
Yeah.
Data provenance, consent. Local models give you more control.
It's not all smooth sailing, though. Some comments mention trouble generating really long outputs.
Yeah, context windows and maintaining coherence over long text can still be tricky, even for big models.
What?
Quantization might sometimes make that harder.
And the tools are still catching up. Like, Llama works, apparently, but VLLM doesn't support these QAT models yet.
That's pretty standard. New model formats, new techniques.
Mm-hmm.
The ecosystem takes a bit of time to adapt. Llama is usually pretty quick, though.
We're also seeing, like, a huge range in experiences based on hardware. Someone got the 12B version running on an 8GD 4060.
The 12 billion parameter one? Okay, that's getting really accessible.
Even on a mobile phone. Galaxy Fold 4, someone claimed.
Wow. Okay, mobile inference for models of that scale.
Hmm.
Now that opens up a whole new world of applications, truly democratizing it.
But, you know, there's skepticism, too. People asking for proper benchmarks, like ELO scores, comparing these quantized models to the originals. Are they really as good?
That's a fair question. Performance isn't just speed, it's quality. We need good evils to know the trade-offs.
And mixed reports on instruction following, especially for complex code generation. Some say it's great, others, not so much.
Yeah, instruction following is often one of the first things to degrade slightly with heavier quantization.
Yeah.
It depends a lot on the task and the quantization method.
Good point. And since those HN threads popped up, Google actually made an official announcement, partnerships with Llama MLX, so they're pushing accessibility.
Makes sense. Getting it into the hands of developers easily is key. This is definitely a space to watch.
Absolutely. Okay, let's shift gears. Movie mistakes. Specifically, Revenge of the Sith. Should they be digitally erased in restorations?
Ah, the age-old debate. Fix the flaws or preserve the history, warts and all.
The argument for fixing is, well, it's like a typo, right? A visible mic boom, a modern object. It wasn't meant to be there. It pulls you out.
Yeah, the correcting unintentional errors argument, like fixing a misspoken line in ADR.
But the other side says, hold on, those limitations, those goofs, they're part of how the film was made then. Changing it is revisionist history.
It reflects the technology, the budget, the constraints of the time. Airbrushing it out loses something, some argue.
The Hacker News comments were really split. Someone made an analogy to music. You might clean up tape hiss. That's a technical flaw.
Right, a limitation of the recording medium.
But you wouldn't auto-tune a slightly flat note from the original performance. That's the art.
That's a pretty good analogy, actually. Separates the performance from the technical capture. Where do digital mistakes fit?
One commenter had a kind of interesting take. Maybe fixing old films is about keeping them relevant. Like, in the future, will people watch these old things if they look dated or flawed compared to, I don't know, TikTok?
Ooh, interesting perspective. The idea that preservation standards might change based on future audience expectations.
But others pushed back hard, like, are you kidding? People still watch Harold Lloyd. Good stories last.
And they do. Plenty of people appreciate classic cinema, imperfections and all. It's part of the charm sometimes.
There were also technical points. People noticing weird color grading in re-releases, maybe bad HDR handling.
Oh yeah, color timing is huge. Messing that up can completely change the mood. Sometimes they find original references and it looks way different, but supposedly more correct. Even that can be controversial.
Definitely. And lots of people just prefer the original look, grain and all. They hate DNR, digital noise reduction.
Yeah, DNR can scrub away the film grain, which is part of the aesthetic. Makes it look plasticky, unnatural sometimes.
Someone mentioned the Star Wars prequel specifically, thinking about the actors working against all that green screen. Must have been tough. That's part of the film's context. You wouldn't fix that.
Good point. The production process itself shapes the final product in visible and invisible ways.
And then someone dropped this line, removing mistakes is like the artistic equivalence of Stalin erasing disfavored figures.
Oh, okay, that's strong language. But it shows how passionately some people feel about preserving the original artifact exactly as it was released.
It really does. On a lighter note, one person said thinking about movie lighting made them appreciate their home office lighting setup more.
It's funny how things connect. Learning about one craft informs another.
Totally. Okay, programming time. ZIG. And its comp time feature.
Right, compile time code execution. It's a pretty central feature in ZIG's design.
The idea is it lets you do stuff during compilation that might replace features like complex macros or maybe even some build script tasks in other languages.
Sort of, yeah. ZIG aims for simplicity. Comp time allows calculations, code generation, checking things at compile time to make the runtime code simpler or faster.
The article mentioned referential transparency in comp time, said it deals with values, not abstract syntax trees, ASTs.
Okay, so what that basically means is when ZIG evaluates something at compile time, it gets a result, a value, like the number 5 or true.
Okay.
It doesn't let you say, inspect the code that produced the 5, like whether it was 2 plus 3 or 1 plus 4. That's different from some powerful macro systems like in Lisp, where macros literally manipulate the code structure, the AST, before it's even compiled.
So ZIG's comp time is simpler in that way, less meta.
Less meta, yeah. Potentially simpler to understand and implement, but maybe less powerful for certain kinds of code generation that rely on manipulating the syntax itself.
Makes sense. Hacker News comments dug into this. Someone clarified that comp time wouldn't distinguish between, say, x plus x and 2x at the syntax level, only their result if x is known.
Exactly. Values, not syntax trees.
Someone else wondered if you could even implement ZIG-style compile time stuff in Common Lisp.
Probably. Lisp macros are famously powerful. You can usually build almost anything with them, though it might not look idiomatic.
One user described comp time as evaluation happening during the ZIG build process. They said it allows more freedom, like doing I.O., which is unusual for compile time.
Ooh, I.O. at compile time. That's interesting. Usually compilers are kept deterministic.
Yeah, but they said the downside is you can't directly generate ZIG types as values within that same compilation pass. You need like an at import step, maybe. Sounds layered.
Okay, that sounds like a trade-off. More power to interact with the outside world during the build, but maybe stricter boundaries within a single compilation unit.
There was definitely some discussion, maybe even concern, about Zig choosing these limitations. Like, why not go for more powerful macros?
It often comes down to language design philosophy. Simplicity, predictability versus ultimate power. Zig leans towards simplicity and explicitness.
And strong opinions about compilers not reaching out to networks or databases. That should be the build system's job, separate concern.
That's a common view. Mm-hmm. Keep the compiler focused on translation, keep it deterministic. Build systems handle the messy external stuff.
Yeah, the determinism point came up a lot. Compilers good, build systems sometimes unpredictable.
True. And some argued, you know, the really powerful macro systems, maybe the cognitive overhead and compiler complexity isn't worth the benefit for most cases.
There was also this distinction between comp time 4 and inline 4. Sounded subtle.
Yeah. Both deal with loops whose bounds are known at compile time. But comp time 4 lets you actually use the loop variable's value at compile time. Inline 4 is more about unrolling or capturing compile time info, but you don't get the value directly at compile time within the loop body in the same way.
Okay, specific details for Zig users there. Someone else wished Zig had a safety mode like Rust.
The memory safety debate. Always lively.
Yeah, sparked discussion about Rust guarantees versus Zig's manual memory management and its trade-offs. Performance, complexity.
Different approaches for different goals. Zig aims to be a C replacement, often prioritizing explicitness and control, even if it means more manual safety work.
Which led to talk about that goal replacing C and Zig's C interop. Is it good enough, or will people eventually want pure Zig?
That's a big question for Zig's future. The C compatibility is crucial now for adoption, letting you use existing libraries.
But will it stay seamless? Or will the community drift towards Zig-only solutions over time?
Hard to say. Often, ecosystems tend to become more self-contained eventually, but C's gravity is strong.
And one last surprise. A user realizing Zig's comp time interpreter actually emulates the target machine.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It means comp time code behaves as it would on the target, which helps with cross compilation and consistency. Deep stuff.
Definitely deep. Okay, let's switch to history and math. The integral of second x took 100 years to solve. Seriously.
It sounds crazy, right? Something you learn in Kelty, maybe. But yeah, the story's fascinating.
The article connects it to Gerardus Mercator, the map guy. From 1569.
The very same. He needed this integral for his famous map projection.
But he couldn't solve it.
Nope. He knew what he needed mathematically, how much to stretch the map vertically at different latitudes, but couldn't find the exact formula. He used numerical approximations, sums.
Wow. And his map was revolutionary for navigation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because rum lines of constant compass bearing are straight lines on his map.
Mm.
Made plotting a course way easier for sailors.
So how did he achieve that without the integral?
He figured out the principle that you needed to stretch the vertical scale by the second of the latitude to counteract the horizontal stretching away from the equator. He essentially summed up these stretch factors numerically.
Clever. So the exact solution, it came 86 years later, 1645, and without calculus.
That's the story. Calculus was just being developed then by Newton and Leibniz. The formal proof using calculus methods came even later, around 1668.
So nearly 100 years from Mercator needing it to having a proper proof.
99 years, yeah. It shows that math progress isn't always linear. Sometimes the need arises long before the tools are fully developed.
And we still use Mercator projection today, don't we? Like on web maps.
Many of them, yeah. Google Maps, Apple Maps use variations. Even though it distorts areas massively near the poles, its property for navigation and local shapes is still useful.
So this 100-year-old math problem is still embedded in our phones.
Pretty much. The article touches on other projections too, like equirectangular, which is simpler but doesn't have that constant bearing property. Mercator's innovation was key.
Okay, so how was it solved without calculus in 1645?
This is where it gets interesting. It involves mathematical tables. Before calculators, people relied heavily on pre-computed tables for trig functions, logarithms.
Right, big books of numbers.
Exactly. Edward Wright published tables specifically for Mercator's map calculations back in 1599. Then John Napier invented logarithms in 1614, which was a huge deal. Log trig tables became popular.
Logarithms turn multiplication into addition, right? Easier calculations.
Precisely. So the legend goes, in 1645, a math teacher, Henry Bond, was looking at Wright's Mercator table and a table of natural logarithms of the tangent function.
Okay. bit obscure.
Totally. And he noticed the numbers look really similar, just offset by 45 degrees and maybe a scaling factor. He basically conjectured, based on comparing table values, that the integral of secant x was Russant x.
He's just spotted it in the number.
Apparently. It was an incredible piece of pattern matching across different mathematical tables. Not a proof, but a very strong, correct conjecture found through observation.
That's amazing. And the article shows the derivative check, which is easy once you know the answer.
Yep. Differentiating glove x plus tan gets you back to Sask. It confirms his guess. It really makes you think, like you said in calculus class, integration feels like guesswork sometimes. Maybe it literally was sometimes.
Huh. Finding the answer by differentiation, working backward. What a story.
A great piece of mathematical history hidden in a standard formula.
Okay, finally, the big acquisition news. OpenAI buying Windsurf for a reported $3 billion.
Yeah, that landed with a bit of a thud. Big number, company not super widely known.
Windsurf sounds like a sport. Google searches weren't helping much initially.
Exactly. It's a coding tool startup, apparently related to or the same as Codeium, which might be more familiar to some developers as an AI code assistant.
The article author speculated maybe this is just peak AI hype, inflated valuation.
It's certainly a possibility people are discussing. $3 billion is a lot, especially when compared to, say, Google buying Wiz, which is a much larger security company.
And the big question on Hacker News was, why didn't OpenAI just build this themselves?
Right. They have OpenAI Codex. They power GitHub Copilot. They have immense AI talent and resources. Building an AI coding assistant or IDE plugin seems, well, doable for them.
People pointed out that competitors like Cursor have pretty small teams. It shouldn't be that hard for OpenAI, should it?
You wouldn't think so.
Yeah.
And there's skepticism about the money. OpenAI burns cash. Is the $3 bill of acquisition the best use of it right now?
All valid points. But there were counterarguments too, justifications for the price tag.
Like what?
Access to Windsurf's enterprise customers. Apparently they had deals with Zillow, Dell, Anduril. Big names.
Ah, the Acquihire Plus customer list. Buying immediate enterprise traction can be worth a lot, faster than building it organically.
Another angle, on-premise solutions. Maybe Windsurf had a strong offering for companies that need AI coding tools but can't send code to the cloud, air-gapped environments.
That's a very plausible driver. Security and privacy concerns are huge in enterprise. If Windsurf cracked the on-prem AI coding nut, that's valuable IP and market access.
The growth of Windsurf Codeium was also mentioned. Maybe OpenAI just saw a fast-growing competitor and decided buying was better than competing.
Happens all the time. Acquire the talent, the tech, the momentum, a talent and distribution play, essentially. Get a dedicated team focused solely on this.
Then the conversation shifted a bit to this idea of vibe coding.
Vibe coding. What's that?
Using AI to code without really knowing how to code, like telling the AI the vibe of what you want.
Yeah.
For non-programmers.
Oh, okay. Like natural language programming taken to the extreme.
Yeah. Some argued this could eventually kill off a lot of the current low-code platforms.
Interesting idea. Democratizing software creation even further.
But others were skeptical, saying curated low-code systems offer reliability and structure that vibe coding might lack.
And the potential for generating insecure, unmaintainable spaghetti code if non-experts are just telling an AI to make it work.
Yeah.
Big risks there.
Someone suggested vibe tasking, automating general office work, might be the real huge market, maybe bigger than coding.
That makes sense. Automating spreadsheets, yeah. Emails, reports. That affects way more people directly.
There were anecdotes, too, about non-technical folks actually contributing to code bases using AI tools.
Which raises questions, right? Mm. Who wrote the code? The person who wrote the prompt? Or the AI? How do you manage that?
Exactly. And it's funny, people remembered past HN discussions speculating OpenAI might buy Cursor, another AI coding tool.
So yeah, it seems OpenAI has been shopping in this aisle for a while. This Windsurf deal looks like a decisive move into the developer tooling space beyond just providing APIs.
Definitely a major strategic play. So that wraps up our tour through today's Hacker News highlights.
From local AI on consumer chips, to preserving films, to Zig's internals, a math history lesson, and a multi-billion dollar AI acquisition.
Quite the mix. It really shows the breadth of what the tech community finds interesting right now.
It does. Lots of different threads connecting technology, history, business, and art.
So, for everyone listening, maybe something to ponder. We talked about local AI, we talked about preserving history, we talked about language design. What connections do you see between making powerful tools more accessible locally and our responsibility to maybe preserve the history of how things were built, flaws and all? Does one influence the other?
Hmm. Interesting thought. Does easy local power make us forget the past struggles, or does it give us new tools to appreciate them?
Something to chew on. Feel free to dive into the threads on Hacker News yourselves. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive on the Ancient Pod.